Hello, my name is Lily, and today I will be reading the Washington Examiner magazine. This is the May 20th through the 27th edition, and we are starting off with the letter to the editor from W. James Antle III, titled, Democrats Discover Rigged Elections. Remember when it was bad to describe elections as rigged? Such terminology was Exhibit A, proving President Donald Trump's anti-democratic tendencies. That's all gone out the window as Democrats protest both Republican redistricting efforts ahead of the midterm elections and the recent Supreme Court Voting Rights Act decision by using the R word. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, New York Democrat, accused the, quote, illegitimate Supreme Court majority, it's the Trump court, he said, of hatching a, quote, scheme to suppress the vote and rig the midterm elections. Quote, the extremists have completely and totally failed America, he added. So they've concluded, aided, and abetted the Trump court, and they have to cheat to win. MAGA has rigged the system, Governor Gavin Newsom, California Democrat, wrote on social media after the Virginia Supreme Court tossed the 10-1 Democratic map on the grounds that the referendum in which it was approved violated the state constitution. Newsom, a leading candidate for the 2028 Democratic presidential nomination, protested that other Republican-led states pursued mid-decade redistricting without a statewide vote at all, as if all state redistricting and constitutional amendment processes are identical or that any were designated by MAGA, or designed by MAGA. Former President Barack Obama urged Virginians to erase all but one of their Republican districts to their purplish state using similar terminology. Quote, Virginia, we are counting on you, he said in an ad. Republicans want to steal enough seats in Congress to rig the next election and wield unchecked power for 2 more years. But you can stop them by voting yes on April 21st. The New Republic warned of Trump's plot to rig midterms as polls turn brutal. One can plausibly object to mid-decade redistricting as a practice, and neither party has clean hands when it comes to partisan gerrymandering. But the steady drumbeat that the election fix is in, maintained by the same people who are themselves using whatever leverage they have to maximize their partisan advantage ahead of voting, goes well beyond such reasonable good government concerns. Before Trump's Stop the Steal machinations in 2020, a poll by The Economist and YouGov found that 2/3 of Democrats believed it was probably or definitely true that, quote, Russia tampered with vote tallies in order to get Donald Trump elected president. That would be quite the steal if it weren't for the fact that there was absolutely no evidence this actually happened. Relatively few elected Democrats went quite this far, but many hinted at it with imprecise assertions that Russia, quote, hacked the election in 2016. Even the more modest claims of Trump-Russia collusion weren't substantiated by the special counsel Robert Mueller's lengthy investigation. Unlike Trump in 2020, Al Gore and Hillary Clinton accepted their election losses, but they also undermined the legitimacy of their Republican opponents' victories to anyone who would listen. What Trump did was a dramatic and dangerous escalation, as is his wont. But the partisan conviction that the election wasn't totally up and up was not his creation, nor has this kind of talk died down among Democrats since then. The only way Democrats are likely to heed the Rahm Emanuel types in their party and moderate ahead of the 2028 election is if they underperform in the midterm elections. But if a disappointing outcome can be even semi-plausibly blamed on gerrymandering or the Supreme Court, even that seems far-fetched. Rigging will further radicalize Democrats. Next up is the Your Land section, starting off with this article titled, California Democrats can't take the heat. No matter where they are from, Republicans are used to taking questions from usually hostile reporters. Since most journalists lean left, but not here at the Washington Examiner, any Republican who has survived at least one election cycle knows how to answer tough questions. But not Democrats, and especially not Democrats with deep blue states, from deep blue states like California. Quote, "By the way, this is a profile piece. This is not a gotcha piece, right?" Former Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra is heard asking KTLA reporter Annie Rose Ramos. "Look, I think these questions are fair. It's in order to learn about you as a candidate," Ramos replied, adding, "I don't know how you define profile, but I'd like to begin the interview." "The way I describe profile is you talk about all the things that I've done, things I want to do, and along with some tough questions, but not only tough questions," Becerra said. Ramos thought the beginning of the interview was so strange, she played it on KTLA's broadcast, telling the anchors, quote, "Honestly, I was caught off guard. To have it start this way before I had even asked a question. I mean, it's about asking some of the hard questions sometimes, but allowing our viewers to get to know each candidate. And so that is why not just myself, but our editors and our executive producers here at KTLA decided to include that portion of this piece." The interview itself turned out to be quite contentious, with Ramos bringing up a New York Times story reporting that Becerra's HHS couldn't find some 85,000 migrant children it released into the country. "That's not accurate," Becerra responded, adding, "I don't know if you got those talking points from Donald Trump." Ramos then responds, "It's from a New York Times article." Becerra then asserts, "That's not what the New York Times article said. The New York Times said that children and their sponsors did not respond to calls. They didn't say we couldn't find kids." In an absolutely devastating fashion, as Becerra is saying these words, KTLA puts the New York Times article on the screen, highlighting the portion of the article reading, quote, "The agency could not reach more than 85,000 children. Overall, the agency lost immediate contact with a third of migrant children." Ramos then reads from her notes, quote, "Working overnight in slaughterhouses, replacing roofs, operating machinery in factories, children as young as 14 years old. That part occurred after the children had left the care of the Department of Health and Human Services," Becerra responded. "So you let these children go into these individual sponsors?" Ramos pressed. Brutal. But at least Becerra did not end the interview halfway through, like former Representative Katie Porter did back in October to CBS reporter Julie Watts. "I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it, thank you," Porter said, before taking her microphone off and leaving. Watts's crime? Asking Porter what she would say to 40% of California voters who cast a ballot for Donald Trump in the 2024 election. "How would I need them in order to win, ma'am?" Porter replied, before ending the interview. If California Democrats wilt this badly under routine questions from local reporters, voters should wonder how they would handle the heat of actually governing. And that was written by Con Carroll. Next up, Uncle Sam on Mother's Day. In recent decades, the Mother's Day discourse, the op-eds, the insufferable millennial-crafted explainers, the viral social media posts, was mostly anti-motherhood. Consider the Salon.com classic, Why I Hate Mother's Day. Why? Quote, "It perpetuates the dangerous idea that all parents are somehow superior to non-parents. Meanwhile, we know the worst, skeeviest, most evil people in the world are CEOs and politicians who are proud parents. We've turned a corner, it seems. On Mother's Day this year, not only were husbands and sons fawning over mothers, but also Uncle Sam, specifically Republicans and conservatives, who traditionally would laud motherhood but fastidiously keep government out of it, tripped over one another to offer policy solutions for mom. Moms.gov launched on Mother's Day this year, promising, quote, resources, information, and help for new and expecting mothers. The website, published by the Trump White House, focused on those mothers in the most distress. Pregnancy centers, not abortion providers, got top billing on moms.gov. The website also provided sound nutrition information for expectant mothers, and of course, a link to create a Trump account, a tax-privileged savings account for children, to which the federal government will contribute $1,000 for every newborn. President Donald Trump and members of his inner circle held a Mother's Day Oval Office press conference to announce the website and a handful of policy changes, tweaking various maternal benefits. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is divorced from the mothers of all six children and who once allegedly told a paramour by text that he wanted to, quote, impregnate her, put a modern twist on the Oval Office event, calling moms.gov a one-stop shop for IVF. Mother's Day affected both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, as some pro-mom legislation was conceived on Capitol Hill. A bipartisan group of congressmen proposed a $2,000 newborn credit. This is a partially refundable tax credit delivered to parents around the time their baby is born. Unlike the standard child care subsidies, parents could use this cash however they want, an au pair, a plane ticket for grandma, or to offset lost wages for staying home. And because some moms on Mother's Day just want their alone time, Representative Blake Moore, Utah Republican, one of the sponsors of that newborn credit, also introduced a bill to get the kids out of the house, the Promoting Childhood Independence and Resilience Act, would try to establish a nationwide norm that setting your child free to roam the neighborhood is not criminal neglect. Sure, Mother's Day 2026 included an unusual amount of content for dog moms, but it should be cheering that more and more folks are deciding that moms matter. And that was written by Timothy P. Carney. Next up, how Democrats treat minors like adults and adults like minors. The emerging worldview of the Democratic Party is that 5-year-olds can make the decision to permanently change their gender, but 21-year-olds are too young to know that committing crimes is wrong. This dichotomy is on display in Massachusetts, one of the most permissive states in the country when it comes to transgender procedures on minors. Boston Children's Hospital famously posted several videos asserting that children can be knowingly transgender in utero, and that the hospital helps gender-confused children begin their transgender process when they are as young as 2 or 3 years old. Meanwhile, Massachusetts Democrats are considering legislation that would move many adult criminal defendants into the juvenile justice system. The bill would gradually raise the age of juvenile jurisdiction to 21 by 2030, meaning 19, 20, and eventually 21-year-old defendants charged with misdemeanors or nonviolent felonies would automatically be handled in juvenile court. Even violent felonies committed by defendants 21 and under could be sent to the juvenile system. The only offenses excluded entirely would be first and second degree murder. Massachusetts glowingly advertises that children under the age of 18 can be emotionally mature enough to seek out and receive permanent hormone replacement and other gender-affirming procedures without their parents' consent. On the other end of that spectrum, Massachusetts may soon decide that 21-year-olds are not emotionally mature enough to know that armed robbery, drug trafficking, stalking, sex trafficking, and other crimes are adult crimes that carry adult punishments. Massachusetts is not alone. California, a sanctuary state for trans youth procedures, has been kicking around a bill that would void life sentences for criminals who committed their crimes before they turned 25. The logic behind these decisions is based on the myth, yes, it is a myth, that your brain reaches full development at the age of 25. Therefore, these poor criminals who are old enough to join the military, drink alcohol, smoke cigarettes, etc., are just too young and naive to know that committing a crime is a bad thing that they shouldn't do. but if they want to permanently alter their body to change their gender, they could begin that process before they are old enough to get their driver's license. How is that for consistent? Democrats want to help criminals go free in the name of holistic justice and reform, and want to let children transition. Therefore, a 12-year-old girl can be wise enough to get a mastectomy, while a 21-year-old carjacker can't be expected to know any better. The inconsistency serves its purpose on both issues. And that is written by Zachary Faria, or Faria. And the final article in the Your Land section is titled, Democrats Have a Political Violence Denial Problem. People usually associate conspiracy theories with the fringe political right. The mainstream left is doing its best to change that narrative. According to a new YouGov poll, 42% of Democrats believe the 2024 Butler, Pennsylvania assassination attempt on President Donald Trump was staged, despite him being shot in the ear on camera. That is an astonishing number. If you walk into any liberal-dominated area, a college campus, a coffee shop, or a vegan grocery store, for example, nearly half the people you meet will believe the president faked or orchestrated his own near murder. And they don't just believe this about the Butler attempt. 34% of Democrats believe the same thing about the White House Correspondents Association dinner shooting, and 26% believe Ryan Routh's attempted assassination at Trump's Florida Golf Club was staged. Two Washington Examiner writers witnessed the Butler shooting, where Trump and three others were shot, one fatally. Roughly a dozen Washington Examiner staff members, including myself, were present at the WHCA dinner shooting at the Washington Hilton. These attempts on Trump's life were not, in fact, staged, and you'd have to be delusional to believe they were. It's especially shocking that the incident Democrats are most likely to believe was staged was the most impossible incident to fabricate. We all watched Trump get shot, we all saw the blood running down his face, and many saw footage of the bloody mess left behind where Corey Kemperatore, David Dutch, and James Copenhaver were shot. You mean to tell me all that blood was fake and Helen Compatore's husband wasn't shot dead while shielding his family? If that's the case, then whose lifeless body did we see get carried into a white tent in the body cam footage? Or is it the theory that the shooting itself was real, but Trump paid a 20-year-old known for having poor aim with a rifle to shoot him in the ear at the exact moment he turned his head to look at a chart on immigration figures? If Trump hadn't turned his head a split second before the gunshot, he'd be a dead man. If 42% of Democrats think that that's what happened, I have a rainbow-colored bridge to sell them. A similar percentage of Democrats denied the results of the 2024 election, despite a complete lack of evidence for their claims. After Trump beat Democrat Kamala Harris 2 years ago, a YouGov poll showed 45% of Democrats saying Harris was the legitimate winner of the election, while NBC reported 41% of Democrats believed the election results were illegitimate. It appears left-wing election deniers have converted into assassination attempt deniers. Alex Jones was destroyed for entertaining conspiracy theories surrounding the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Will mainstream Democrats receive the same condemnation for denying the mass shooting that took place in Pennsylvania, the attempted mass shooting in Washington, D.C., or the failed hit in Florida? Obviously not, because the media hold the left and right to two separate sets of rules. The reason mainstream Democrats believe these assassination attempts were staged is simple. Mainstream Democratic talking points claiming that Trump is a threat to democracy, a fascist, and a bigot have fueled the flames of left-wing political violence, and they don't want to take accountability for inciting it. Case in point, former President Barack Obama claimed that the White House Correspondents Association dinner shooter's motive was unknown well after the suspect's anti-Trump manifesto featuring standard left-wing talking points was made public. If Trump's calling for peaceful and patriotic protests counts as inciting the January 6th, 2021 Capitol riot, then what should we call it when, to name one of many examples, former President Joe Biden says it's time to put Trump in the bullseye? The January 6th rioters disobeyed Trump's order to remain peaceful, while several left-wing gunmen have put bullseyes on Trump since Biden made his comment. Only one of them was impeached for incitement. Again, two sets of rules. That was written by Peter Cordy. Next up, we have this article written by W. James Antle III, titled, "Life After Roe v. Wade Hasn't Been Easy." The pro-life movement is unhappy with President Donald Trump. This discontentment has been building throughout his second non-consecutive term and is coming to a head months before the midterm elections. Trump had won over skeptical social conservatives of most stripes during his first term. Allies billed him the most pro-life president in history. All three of Trump's Supreme Court appointees voted to overturn Roe v. Wade, delivering the biggest pro-life victory in the movement's history. In a 2016 presidential debate, Trump explicitly promised that outcome when moderator Chris Wallace asked if he would like to see Roe reversed. Quote, "Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that will happen, and it will happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court," Trump said. "I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination." But abortions are up slightly since Roe fell in 2022, hitting 1,126,000 clinician-approved abortions last year, according to data compiled by the pro-legal abortion Guttmacher Institute. That's still well below the peak of 1.6 million abortions in 1990, but it is a peak from the trend of declining abortions from much of the 1990s to 2009, and exactly the opposite of what pro-life activists expected from the reversal of the 1973 decision that legalized abortion in most cases throughout the country. One reason that abortions haven't continued falling, despite the Supreme Court's Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision allowing states to ban the procedure, is that the continued availability of mail-order abortion pills has allowed women seeking abortions to circumvent pro-life laws in states where they are on the books. Some states responded to Dobbs by liberalizing their abortion laws further or enshrining legal abortion in their state constitutions. The second Trump administration has allowed continued access to mail-order abortion pills while swearing off new federal abortion restrictions and slow walking a safety review of mifepristone by the Food and Drug Administration. One pro-life leader, who had previously tried to maintain cordial relations with Trump and a place at the table in the White House, is more blunt about the issue. Quote, "Trump is the problem," Marjorie Danielfelser, president of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, told the Wall Street Journal in an article published on May 3rd. "The president is the problem." That's a jarring quote. Pro-life activists worked hard to return Trump to the White House in the 2024 election campaign. He had been an architect of the anti-Roe majority on the Supreme Court, delivering what previous Republican presidents could not. According to exit polls, Trump won 92% of voters who thought abortion should be illegal in most cases, and 88% who believed it should be illegal in all cases. Asked simply whether an abortion should be legal, Trump carried 91% of those who said the practice should be illegal. But Trump also won 29% of voters who said abortion should be legal. He tied former Vice President Kamala Harris 49% to 49% on a more detailed question asking voters if abortion should be legal in most cases. He barely lost to her on the question of who voters trusted more to handle abortion, receiving 46% to Harris's 49%. Trump had skillfully navigated the complexities of public opinion on abortion in the first presidential election since Roe was overturned, while running against only the second female major party nominee. He had previously beaten the first woman nominee, but that was while Roe remained in effect. He did so by running to the right of the Democrats, but to the left of the mainstream pro-life movement. It shouldn't have been a surprise. While Trump was willing to take credit for ending Roe and fulfilling his 2016 campaign promise to nominate conservative judges, he was also quick to reorganize the electoral risks that returning abortion policy to the democratically elected branches of government posed to Republicans. Throughout the run-up to the 2024 Republican primaries and during the election, Trump repeatedly warned the party that abortion was going to be a difficult issue. Democrats, Trump told a GOP fundraising dinner in South Carolina that year, quote, have energized this issue, and the Republicans are going to have to learn how to fight it. I have to tell you, from a conservative and Republican standpoint, you have to learn how to talk about pro-life, and you have to learn how to talk about that decision, Trump said at another GOP fundraising event in Alabama, because you don't know how to talk about it. In order to win in 2024, Republicans must learn how to properly talk about abortion, Trump said at a rally in Dubuque later that year. Trump's advice was to position the Democrats as the extremists on abortion. Quote, remember, the Democrats are radicals, are the radicals on this issue. We're not radicals on this issue, he said. The Democrats are the radicals because they're willing to kill babies in their 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th month, and even after birth. Trump then invoked former Virginia Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, whom he called, quote, that whack job who thought he was Michael Jackson. In 2019, Northam spoke on an area radio station during a dispute over late-term abortions in Virginia, saying, quote, the infant would be delivered, the infant would be kept comfortable, the infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired, and then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. In the primaries, Trump hit Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida Republican, for signing what he deemed an overly strict abortion ban, calling the heartbeat bill a terrible thing and a terrible mistake. DeSantis and former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley tried to capitalize on Trump's abortion triangulation, but were unsuccessful. After Trump won the nomination for the third consecutive time, he weakened the Republican platform planks on abortion and marriage, having left them largely intact during his first two presidential runs. The GOP platform, as adopted in Milwaukee, endorsed Trump's federalist approach of leaving abortion regulations largely to the states. When Trump does engage on abortion from a pro-life perspective, he doesn't mince words or retreat to euphemisms about creating a culture of life. He describes abortion, especially late-term abortions, as killing babies. Quote, if you go with what Hillary is saying, Trump said in a 2016 debate with Clinton, in the 9th month you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother just prior to the birth of the baby. Now you can say that that's okay, Trump continued, and Hillary can say that's okay, but it's not okay with me, because based on what she's saying and based on where she's going and where she's been, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb in the 9th month on the final day, and that's not acceptable. Like most issues, Trump also talks about abortion as something that can be negotiated. Quote, pro-lifers have a tremendous power right now. Now, with that termination of Roe to negotiate. They had none, Trump told Alabama Republicans. They didn't have any before that ruling. They had no power whatsoever. People could kill babies at any time they wanted, including after what we would call birth. They could kill babies. Now, pro-lifers have tremendous power. Trump made a similar argument in an interview that year. Quote, but on pro-life, I will tell you that what I did on Roe vs. Wade, nobody else, for 50 years, they've been trying to do it. I got it done, he said. And now we're in a position to make a really great deal and a deal that people want. We're in a position now, and I'm going to be leading the charge. We're in the position now where we get to do, where we can get something that the whole country can agree with, and that's only because I got us out of Roe vs. Wade, where the pro-life people had absolutely nothing to say, Trump said. We're going to agree to a number of weeks or months, or however you want to define it, Trump told NBC's Meet the Press, the same show on which he originally said he was pro-choice in 1999, causing pro-lifers to initially view his first Republican presidential campaign with suspicion. But even on the narrow question of in vitro fertilization, Trump has learned that such deal-making on moral issues is easier said than done. Trump's May IVF announcement at the White House was an olive branch to the pro-life movement, but most anti-abortion activists believe the embryo destruction involved in the practice is immoral. Universal IVF coverage proponents were also unhappy with Trump's proposal, which included concessions to pro-lifers who didn't want to see paying for IVF mandated under Obamacare. Trump's team has taken other steps to make things right with pro-lifers. There have been meetings at the White House. Marty McCary, who was also unpopular with the pharmaceutical industry, has been ousted at the FDA. Dr. Macri was uniquely destructive to the pro-life movement, Senator Josh Hawley said after the FDA chief stepped down under pressure. His resignation is an opportunity for the FDA to reset. A larger problem, however, isn't Trump. Now that Republicans can actually follow through on the things they have long said they wanted to do about abortion, the political risks are greater. A May 5th YouGov poll found that 48% support making abortion pills available by mail, quote, even if they are accessible in states with abortion restrictions, compared to 27% who are opposed. 47% say medical abortions are safe, to 21% who believe it is unsafe, and 33% who aren't sure. In Gallup's polling, public identification with the pro-life position peaked at 51% in 2009 and fell as low as 39% in the weeks before the Dobbs decision, which was leaked early in May 2022. The split in 2025 was 51% pro-choice to 43% to pro-life. Last year, 35% said abortion should be legal only under a few circumstances, 30% said abortion should be legal under all circumstances, 19% said it should be legal in most cases, and 13% said it should be illegal in all cases. These numbers fluctuate less historically than the pro-choice versus pro-life split. Democrats have taken to describing virtually any pro-life law passed at the federal level as a, quote, national abortion ban. Trump, during the 2024 campaign, fought hard to prevent this branding from sticking to Republicans, emphasizing repeatedly that he was going to leave abortion up to the states. When the Supreme Court heard Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, many thought Roe would be overturned then. Abortion rights activists feared Justice Clarence Thomas, who was narrowly confirmed after a bitter fight in 1991, would be the fifth vote against Roe after nearly a dozen years of Republican presidents. Instead, three Reagan appointees and one justice nominated by George H.W. Bush voted with the liberals to uphold the essence of Roe. Pro-lifers were bitterly disappointed, but Casey did expand the range of abortion restrictions that were permissible under the court's jurisprudence. This largely shifted the abortion debate in the pro-life movement's favor, with a focus on parental notification laws, bans on late-term abortions, and particularly grisly procedures like partial birth abortion and restrictions on taxpayer funding of abortion. 30 years later, Dobbs was the legal victory the pro-life movement hoped for since 1973. Not a single one of Trump's nominees to the Supreme Court let them down. Trump kept his word that Roe would be overturned if he could appoint 2 or 3 justices. But by allowing pro-life elected officials to regulate abortion in ways that weren't as popular as banning partial birth abortion, Dobbs may have shifted the political debate back in favor of the pro-choice side. Democrats used abortion to minimize their losses in the 2022 midterm elections, though Republicans still won control of the House. Pro-lifers suffered losses in ballot initiatives, not just in reliably blue states, but also in more favorable terrain like Ohio and Kansas. Abortion stopped declining and started rising again. The movement had managed to get Trump to flip-flop in favor of their abortion position without much pressure in 2015 and 16. Yet they were powerless to stop him from watering down the abortion plank in the Republican platform that had been pro-life since Reagan. By this reading, Trump is reacting to real political conditions rather than being the main problem of the pro-life movement's problems, or the main cause of the pro-life movement's problems. In any case, or in any event, Trump's successors will soon need to grapple with abortion on their own. Pro-lifers will have to try to exert political pressure on the 2028 Republican presidential primary field while resisting the election of Democrats who want to pass a federal abortion law that is more permissive than the Casey regime under the guise of codifying Roe. The pro-life challenge will be ensuring that Dobbs was not a Pyrrhic victory, but the starting point for a culture and government policy that is more protective of unborn human life. It won't be easy. They have virtually no Democratic support, and Republicans are proving to be less reliable allies than previously thought. But as the Trump era comes to a close, pro-lifers will have no choice but to start anew. Once again, that article was written by W. James Antle III, who is executive editor of the Washington Examiner magazine. Next up is this article by Michael M. Rosen, titled "The U.S.-China AI War Heats Up. Chinese developers employ a variety of suspicious tactics to close the gap with America." The agenda at President Donald Trump's Beijing summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping included trade, tariffs, rare earth metals, Taiwan, Iran, religious freedom, and various other topics, but one pressing matter attracted little attention from the leader of the world's 2 most powerful countries: their escalating race to dominate advances in artificial intelligence. In recent months, AI developers in China, at the behest of and with the substantial assistance from the Chinese Communist Party, have closed the gap with their counterparts in the United States, often using highly suspicious means of doing so. In parallel, Beijing appears to be orchestrating, through none other than Senator Bernie Sanders, Vermont independent, a campaign to stymie the growth of American data centers, the behemoth facilities that power the AI revolution. If policymakers fail to respond to the CCP's mounting challenge, the U.S. will find itself on the short end of the most important technological revolution this century. So, how exactly did China manage to nearly catch up to America's tech giants? What role are Xi and his minions playing, and how can we fight back? The gap narrows. Last month, Stanford University's Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence released a study finding that China is rapidly closing the AI gap with the U.S. For years, the researchers concluded, the U.S. outpaced all other global regions on AI in model size, performance, artificial intelligence, research, citations, and more. But China emerged as an AI counterweight to the U.S., gradually gaining ground, and this year it appears to have nearly erased any U.S. lead. The Institute discovered that in February 2025, China's DeepSeek Route 1 model, or R1 model, equaled the level of the most advanced U.S. AI, and that currently, Anthropic's top model leads its Chinese counterpart by a near 2.7%. That gap had previously been in the double digits, with some experts estimating it would have taken China more than 7 months to catch up to the U.S. In addition, and maybe more problematically, the researchers found that China leads its publication volume citation, or leads in publication volume, citations, patent output, and industrial robot installations, and that the number of AI scholars moving to the United States has dropped 89% since 2017. How has this all happened? How does a country that invented an entire field and pioneered its signal breakthroughs now find itself on the back foot? For one, the CCP has pumped tens of billions of dollars into AI research, outstripping even the USA March study by the Association. A March study by the Association of American Universities found that, for the first time in history, overall Chinese research and development investment topped American research and development $1.03 trillion to $1.01 trillion. A 2025 RAND survey concluded that Beijing seeks to develop a $100 billion AI industry by 2030 and has created an $8.2 billion fund solely for machine learning startups. Chinese AI firms also benefit from the so-called second mover advantage, meaning they can piggyback on advanced models developed in the US and make them far more efficient. For instance, China's DeepSeek version 3.2, introduced late last year, purports to incorporate an efficient attention mechanism that substantially reduces computational complexity while preserving model performance in long context scenarios. But Xi and the state instruments he controls appear to also be exploiting American weaknesses, including through highly suspect methods. Last month, I attended a hearing of the bipartisan House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party entitled China's Campaign to Steal America's AI Edge. Chairman Representative John Molinar, Michigan Republican, kicked off the proceedings by contending that China's smuggling of advanced AI chips is a pervasive threat facing law enforcement, and noting that just last month, the Department of Justice announced a $2.5 billion chip smuggling case, which would be the largest export control violation in U.S. history. Molinar then asked, why is China so desperate to acquire U.S.-designed chips? The reason is obvious. AI is a truly transformative technology. It's already changing how we fight wars, run our government, and operate companies. He concluded that it is essential for the United States to maintain a decisive lead in the AI race. We cannot afford a future where Beijing dominates this technology. At the hearing, Dmitry Alperovitch, the founder and chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator, echoed Molinar, asserting that we are in a race and the stakes could not be higher. Artificial intelligence will transform every industry, every battlefield, and every government. Alperovitch also predicted that whoever fields the best models running on the best infrastructure will likely win not just the AI race itself, but the 21st century. The single most important input to winning is compute, the processing power used to train and run AI models. In addition, Yusuf Mahmood, the director of AI and Emerging Technology Policy at the America First Policy Institute, reiterated that it used to be the case that, quote, China's frontier AI capabilities are generally considered to be about 7 months behind America's. He also specified how Chinese actors have pilfered American AI breakthroughs, including through distillation, a process where users create accounts on pioneer models like GPT or Claude, query the models en masse, and hoover up the data. According to Mahmood, other examples of Chinese misconduct include stealing trade secrets and poisoning pioneer models by hacking into their training datasets and implanting false or faulty data. These attacks, he explained, already have dangerous effects. The American trade secrets, capabilities, and hardware that China steals directly feed its economy and Beijing's military apparatus, including technology shipped around the globe to U.S. adversaries and rogue sales, Mahmood testified. Just recently, the Iranian regime used weapons systems powered by Chinese AI technology to attack American warfighters. In short, China is quickly eroding the once impregnable wall that the U.S. believed it had built around AI. The battle over data centers. But it's worse than that. China appears to be working hard to suppress future American AI breakthroughs by stoking opposition to the data centers that have sprouted like wildfires across the country. These massive complexes, which each comprise thousands of servers and graphics processing units, power the computing revolution. According to Goldman Sachs, American AI titans are spending more than $700 billion in 2025 and 2026 combined on building out data centers. OpenAI's projects alone amount to nearly $1 trillion in infrastructure investment. Data centers naturally levy massive power demands on the electrical grid, and for this reason, many of the leading U.S. tech companies have invested heavily on increasing capacity. Early this year, OpenAI announced a $1 billion alliance with SB Energy. Microsoft is working to bring the Three Mile Island nuclear facility online for the first time in decades. Meta has been exploring space-based solar energy, and NVIDIA has partnered with the Siemens and Bill Gates to develop a fusion power plant. But progressive activists and local residents near the sites of these data centers have aligned to oppose the projects, notwithstanding the tax dollars and jobs they will generate for their respective communities. Numerous recent legacy media articles have lamented the supposed catastrophes these facilities will spark, and Sanders has emerged as their leading antagonist in Congress. Quote, "We need a federal moratorium on AI data centers," Sanders announced in a March press release along with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, New York Democrat. "We cannot sit back and allow a handful of billionaire big tech oligarchs to make decisions that will reshape our economy, our democracy, and the future of humanity. We need serious public debate and democratic oversight over this enormously consequential issue." Sanders has also emerged more broadly as a vigorous opponent of the computing revolution. In a Wall Street Journal op-ed entitled, "AI is a threat to everything the American people hold dear," the senior senator from Vermont argued that AI is, quote, "undermining our democracy, damaging the environment, posing an existential threat to the human race, threatening our privacy, and reshaping how we as humans relate to one another." His proposed moratorium is the progressive equivalent of a total and complete shutdown until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. But a Chinese wrinkle has recently emerged in Sanders' anti-AI advocacy. In late April, he convened a discussion on Capitol Hill titled, "The Existential Threat of AI and the Need for International Cooperation," which prominently featured Xu Lan, a professor at Tsinghua University, and Sheng Li, dean of the Beijing Institute of AI Safety and Governance. How a U.S. senator would turn to Chinese experts to share their insights on AI safety boggles the mind, especially when Beijing is a ruthless is ruthlessly hurtling headlong toward rapid AI expansion without any of the safeguards that democratic governance provides. An irony seemingly lost a member of the greatest deliberative body in history. Seeking Chinese input on how to ethically and responsibly develop technology calls to mind foxes and henhouses, arsonists and firemen, and many other similar metaphors, none of them favorable. So ill-advised was the Vermonter's gambit that the Washington Post editorial board proclaimed that, quote, Bernie Sanders' AI cooperation fantasy is dangerous. Even more sharply, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent wrote that, quote, instead of harnessing American innovation, Senator Sanders is inviting foreign nationals to tell the United States how to regulate AI. The real threat to AI safety is letting any nation other than the United States set the global standard. Perhaps fittingly, Sanders has consistently served as a useful idiot to left authoritarian regimes, and this occasion appears to be no exception. A pity, then, that instead of bolstering the American AI position, the former Burlington mayor has allowed Beijing to unduly perniciously influence our policy. How to fight back? So, what can be done? How can American AI giants retain their edge? What can the federal government do to ensure we win? And how can China's highly assertive strategy effectively be countered? Fortunately, many of our best minds are hard at work on this very problem, beginning with the CCP Select Committee, which itself has reportedly been the target of attempted Chinese espionage. For instance, at the April hearing, the Silverado Policy Accelerator's Dmitry Alperovich urged rigorous enforcement of the prohibition on selling advanced AI chips to China. Quote, to ensure that we do not arm the enemy, Alperovich argued, we need to first hold the line on export controls, close the loopholes, and ensure penalties effectively deter violations. Providing China with cutting-edge AI chips is the modern equivalent to selling rockets to the Soviets during the space race. Along similar lines, the America First Policy Institute's Yusuf Mahmood exhorted that the committee to establish security standards for frontier AI labs, create the Anti-Distillation Task Force, and authorize and fund agencies like the Bureau of Emerging Threats and the Center for AI Standards and Innovation. Quote, the threat from the CCP will bring new challenges, Mahmood said. To predict them, the federal government needs small, talent-dense, empowered offices focused on understanding AI's future. Around the same time, the Office of Science and Technology Policy issued a memorandum on the adversarial distillation of American AI models, cautioning that Chinese foreign entities have been, quote, leveraging tens of thousands of proxy accounts to evade detection and using jailbreaking techniques to expose proprietary information in order to, quote, systematically extract capabilities from American AI models, exploiting American expertise and innovation. In response, OSTP vowed to, quote, work together with private industry to develop best practices to identify, mitigate, and remediate industrial-scale distillation activities and build strong defense against such activities, and to explore a range of measures to hold foreign actors accountable for industrial-scale distillation campaigns. In addition, my American Enterprise Institute colleague Klon Kitchen, who's closely monitoring our competition with China, recently sounded an alarm and offered some helpful suggestions. Quote, China, Russia, and North Korea aren't waiting for my mythos, Kitchen wrote, in reference to the Anthropic model that identified a plethora of cybersecurity vulnerabilities across a wide range of platforms. They're extracting what's already available from other AI models and running their own programs in parallel. To vigorously respond to this threat, Kitchen contended, the U.S. must actively facilitate deterrence against the kinds of international cyber threats that Beijing presents. Quote, "We should say explicitly that we hold governments responsible for attacks originating within their borders or infrastructure, regardless of whether they claim the attackers are independent criminals," he opined. "We should say that attacks on American critical infrastructure, power, water, finance, defense, are acts of aggression that will draw a response from the full range of American capability." Even beyond strategies for countering the CCP's aggressive AI posture, there's also reason to hope that AI may actually corrode the communist regime's core from within. Cameron Berg, a prominent AI researcher, argued in the Wall Street Journal that large language models like ChatGPT and even DeepSeek may eventually penetrate Beijing's Great Firewall. In an op-ed entitled "AI is Bound to Subvert Communism," Berg wrote that, quote, "Even China's heavily censored chatbots have proved difficult to contain within the party's ideological boundaries." Optimistically, quote, "American frontier models, running without those constraints and deployed inside China, would be more potent still. A personal tutor in open inquiry for every user, engaging any question, exploring any line of reasoning, without third-party mediation." Berg summarized a study by European researchers who managed to crack the CCP-imposed censorship function from the Chinese DeepSeek model and, quote, "found that the underlying system answered freely about every topic Beijing had tried to suppress, including seemingly verboten topics like the Tiananmen Square massacre. Thus, not all news is bad, but China is unquestionably gunning hard to outpace the U.S. in AI dominance across a number of disturbing domains. Only a vigilant and forceful response can ensure American leadership in this critical technology." And with that, that's all the time we have for today's reading of The Washington Examiner. This was the May 20th through 27th edition. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful rest of your day.